Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Tuesday, June 6th, 2023. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette, three bodies found in collapsed building. This is an AP story from Davenport. The remains of all three men caught inside the Davenport apartment building that partially collapsed last week have been removed, the city's police chief said Monday, as survivors began filing lawsuits asserting that negligence led to the structural failure. We don't have any other information at this time that there are any additional people missing, Chief Jeff Bladel said at a news conference. Police chief said Brandon Colvin Sr., 42, was recovered Saturday. Ryan Hitchcock, 51, was recovered Sunday, and Daniel Prien, 60, was recovered early Monday. He did not say if they died immediately after the May 28 collapse, but autopsies will be performed on all three. Officials rescued seven people immediately after the collapse, escorted another dozen out of the building, and rescued another person from the rubble with an on-site amputation. But less than 12 hours after the collapse, officials said they had no credible information that anyone had died and ordered the immediate demolition of the unstable building. The comments drew community backlash from families and friends of those who were still missing and others who urged the city to continue searching. Then, hours later, on May 29, another person, Lisa Brooks, was rescued from a fourth-story window. Rescue and recovery efforts continued after the city activated a state rescue task force based in Cedar Rapids. Iowa Task Force 1 Urban Search and Rescue Chief Rick Halloran said during the news conference Monday the recoveries brought some closure to the men's families over the weekend. As we come into today's operations, following the goals and objectives by the command staff of the city and the incident management team, in all hopes, it looks like we'll be wrapping things up shortly, Halloran said. That being said, they are still working, things are dynamic, and they still can be changing. The hope is that we will be entering a new chapter, a new phase in the process of working through the aftermath of the collapse. Davenport officials said they were consulting with experts about how to safely bring down the rest of the structure. The city fire marshal earlier said explosives would not be used because it's close to other buildings in a busy part of downtown Davenport. Mayor Mike Mattson said Monday that neither he nor other city officials have been in touch with building owner Andrew Wold since the collapse. County records show that Wold's Davenport Hotel LLC acquired the building in a 2021 deal worth $4.2 million. Wold released a statement dated May 30 saying, quote, "Our thoughts and prayers are with our tenants," end quote. He has made no statement since then. Bladel said the Davenport Fire Marshal's office had begun an investigation of the building collapse with help from the State Division of Criminal Investigation, Davenport Police, and the Medical Examiner's Office. Last week, Scott County Prosecutor Kelly Cunningham cautioned against assuming a criminal prosecution is appropriate, saying an independent investigation needs to be conducted into the cause of the building's structural failure. Unresolved questions include why neither the owner nor city officials warned residents about potential danger. A structural engineer's report issued days before the collapse indicated a wall of the century-old building was at imminent risk of crumbling. A recording of a 911 call placed just the day before the partial collapse revealed the director of an organization affiliated with the Chamber of Commerce reported a contractor's concerns about a wall's integrity. City fire officials responded by visiting the site for less than 5 minutes, a log shows. Residents have started filing lawsuits. Dana Feuerbach escaped her fifth-floor apartment during the collapse with just her purse. Everything else she kept in her home of 20 years was gone. Feuerbach filed a lawsuit Monday against Wold and others. One of her attorneys is Jeffrey Goodman of the Philadelphia-based firm of Saltz, Mongaluzzi Bendeski, who specializes in structural collapse cases and represented victims in the 2021 Surfside condominium collapse in Florida. The litigation ultimately settled for $1.2 billion. The complaint names Wold Davenport Hotel LLC, Andrew Wold Investments LLC, Select Structural Engineering LLC, Bi-State Masonry Inc., the City of Davenport, Waukee Investments LLC, and Park Wild Properties LLC as defendants. The court filing states that Feuerbach has suffered injuries to her physical, psychological, and emotional well-being, including head trauma, that are permanent in nature. Goodman said Feuerbach is still recovering from the collapse and will not be doing any media interviews. But Feuerbach spoke with the Quad City Times in the days after the collapse. When it first happened, I didn't know, I didn't realize the finality of it, Feuerbach said then. I guess I thought, well, this is just awful, but somehow there'll be repairs and we'll go on living back in the building. But then we realized pretty soon that that was it, that the building was going to be coming down, but we'd never get back in again and we'd lose everything. And boy, that realization was awful. A news release from the law firm asserted the owner and the City of Davenport's inspectors were warned on May 24, 2023, that the building appeared ready to fall imminently. This disaster in Davenport was a preventable tragedy. All the victims and their families are in our hearts, and they all deserve justice, Goodman said. This lawsuit is the first step toward seeking justice and answers on behalf of the victims. Another lawsuit filed Friday in Scott County identifies plaintiff Mildred Harrington as a resident of the building and plaintiff Rija Garnett as a resident of a nearby building that the suit says was impacted. Davenport Hotel LLC is the defendant. The suit accuses Davenport Hotel LLC of failing in its responsibility to the plaintiffs, including failing to maintain the building in a reasonably safe condition and failing to warn residents of structural concerns. There potentially could be more plaintiffs in the suit, according to court records. The complaint describes Harrington and Garnett as representative of larger classes of people impacted by the collapse, but a judge would have to authorize it as class action suit. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds toured the site Monday morning and tweeted later that the state is providing support and resources while working with city officials. Thank you to the first responders for putting their lives at risk to help their community, she wrote. The building, built as a hotel in 1907, had been converted into about 80 apartment units that were home to roughly 50 people. The state earlier made $5,000 available to displaced tenants who met income requirements, and the city offered $6,000 to the people forced from their homes. On Monday, the governor also waived the fees for tenants who needed to get their driver's license replaced. Also on the front page, diary buyer searching for Fairfax man's descendants. This story is by Grace King. Long-lost diaries of a man who lived in Fairfax in the 1940s eventually will be returned to his great-grandson by a Massachusetts woman who acquired them for research from the online marketplace eBay. The diaries were purchased a few years ago by Addie Katerina, 26, an elementary art teacher in Massachusetts, who researches historic diaries and artifacts with the goal of returning them to their descendants. Katerina reads and transcribes the diaries live on TikTok, the social media video platform, and has amassed a following of people she calls the Diary Detectives. Together, the group is researching Delaney, his family, and his life in Fairfax to learn about the time period and hopefully return the diaries to his descendants, Katerina said. Katerina reached out to the Gazette last month asking for help locating the descendants of the diarist, Thomas, known as Todd Delaney. The Gazette was able to locate Jim Delaney, 65, of Cedar Rapids, the great-grandson of Todd Delaney. The ultimate goal is to return these diaries to someone who would appreciate them, Katerina said. Jim, who reached his own dead end in searching his family's history, hopes the diaries will give him clues about his ancestry. Having the diaries for himself would mean a great deal, he said. Katerina has three of at least 10 diaries Todd Delaney kept during his lifetime. The diaries she has are from the years 1943, 1944, and 1947. The eBay seller Katerina purchased the diaries from was selling between 10 and 15 diaries at the time, she said. There are probably 8 other diaries out there in chronological order from Delaney. I wish I had gotten more, but I didn't know at the time how special the story was, Katerina said. She calls Delaney's diaries the Weatherman Diaries because he began each entry with the description of the weather. It wasn't until a few weeks into researching the diary that she learned Delaney's name was Thomas, or Todd. Todd's son Lloyd and grandson Roger also were avid diarists, Jim said. Jim recalls that his father, Roger, also began each entry with a description of the weather. Emily LaFramboise, who lives in Michigan, came across Katerina's TikTok a couple months ago and now considers herself one of the diary detectives. I've always been drawn to old letters, postcards, and diaries at antique shops and thrift stores. I didn't know other people even had an interest until I stumbled across one of Katerina's lives on TikTok, she said. Each of the diary detectives bring a strength to the group. Hers is being able to read really difficult handwriting, she said. It feels good to be able to decipher some writing with other participants cheering you on. LaFramboise said she and the other diary detectives want so badly to connect with people in Fairfax who may have more information about the family. She's even mapped the route. It's an 8-hour drive from her home. We want to see a picture of Todd. We cannot find a picture of him, she said. Katerina and the other diary detectives still are working through reading Delaney's diaries. They have finished 1943 and are in the middle of 1944. In the 1943 diary, Delaney suddenly stopped writing in July. He's writing every day consistently, and then he stops for 2 months, Katerina said. When the diary picks up again, the handwriting is completely different, but still written from his perspective. For a long time, we didn't know what this meant, Katerina said. Eventually, they found Delaney's death certificate, which mentioned he suffered a stroke in July 1943. He died in 1944. Katerina, however, has a diary from 1947. His wife must have kept writing for him, which is so sweet, she said. Katerina said Delaney went from being really active, mowing his lawn every day and taking care of the farm, to doing small tasks after his stroke. A small walk for him every other day is a big deal, she said. One of Katerina's favorite stories is when Delaney talks about walking down the street to the train tracks to wave at his son Lloyd, who worked for the railway mail service, as he rode by. That entry is so sad, it's almost like you get to know these people, Katerina said. The hobby of collecting and researching diaries began when Katerina purchased a diary from an estate sale about 5 years ago. It was the handwriting in the diary that caught her eye, along with the newspaper clippings, pictures and poems glued to the pages like a scrapbook, Katerina said. Piece by piece, the story kept coming together. Katerina soon learned the diary was written in 1917 by a Brooklyn socialite named Angelcia Hewlett. Katerina was able to get in touch with Hewlett's granddaughter to return the diary to the family. It's a year in the life of a grandmother she never knew anything about, Katerina said. Katerina continues to look for diaries she can research. While reading the diary, she picks out places, people, and clues she can further research through newspaper archives and Ancestry.com, a collection of online family history records. Katerina said she reached out to people on Ancestry.com and Facebook, trying to get in touch with Delaney's descendants. I'd love to talk to anyone, even if they're not a relative, she said. Katerina said she has learned that Delaney's daughter, Edna, lived in Fairfax for the rest of her life and didn't have any children. His son, Lloyd, had 3 sons, she said. Katerina said she also has learned that Delaney's wife, whose name also was Edna, had the maiden name of Gibson. Edna's parents, Amos and Emma Gibson, owned a hotel called the Star Hotel, which now is the Star Bar and Grill, 303 Church Street in Fairfax. Legend has it Lloyd was actually born inside the Star Hotel, but we can't verify that, said Jim, corroborating these facts. Addie Katerina can be found on TikTok or YouTube. Her website for the Weatherman Diaries is sites.google.com/view/The Weatherman Diaries. To contact Katerina about the Todd Delaney Diaries or to share photos with her of historic Fairfax, you can email her thingslostandfound1@gmail.com. Also on the front page, I'll abbreviate this story, a Cedar Rapids teen must serve at least 50 years. This story is by Trish Mahaffey. A Cedar Rapids teen who killed his parents with two knives and an axe on October 14, 2021, will have to serve a mandatory minimum of 50 years of a life sentence before being eligible for parole. Ethan Orton, who attacked his mother, Misty Scott Slade, 41, after she fell asleep in a chair, and his father, Casey Arthur Orton, 42, who was asleep on a sofa, told a psychologist they emotionally and verbally abused him all his life. And when his mother sent him an email the day before saying that he has to move out when he turned 18 in 5 months, it pushed him to attack. Assistant Linn County Attorney Mike Harris, during his sentencing recommendation on Monday, pointed out just how Ethan Orton committed his heinous attack. In abbreviating, in Trenell's testing, Orton showed planning, judgment, and decision-making abilities. He had minimal depression and anxiety, but showed a mild level of paranoia. Trenell said he concluded Orton was normal and didn't meet the criteria for a mental health diagnosis. Turning to page 2 on the Iowa Today page, a soldier dies 2 weeks after Iowa City crash. This by Emily Anderson. An Iowa National Guard soldier who was 3 weeks away from retirement from the Guard has died after being struck by a vehicle May 22nd in Iowa City. The Iowa City Police Department confirmed Monday that Corey J. Height, 45, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday morning nearly 2 weeks after the crash. The department had not previously identified the pedestrian hit in the crash, which happened just after 4 p.m. that day at the intersection of Melrose Avenue and Kennedy Parkway. The police department also hasn't released information about the driver of the vehicle that struck the soldier or whether any charges related to the crash are being contemplated. The Gazette requested a recording of the 911 call related to the crash, but the request was denied because police said the crash remained under investigation. Height was out for a jog when he was hit. He has spent the last couple of weeks in the hospital with serious injuries, including a pelvis fracture, multiple skull fractures, holes in his lung and kidney, and brain swelling, according to the GoFundMe page started on behalf of the family. The fundraising page had raised over $4,600 by Monday afternoon. According to information posted on behalf of Height's family to a Caring Bridge site, the family met last week with doctors to discuss his injuries and the potential outlook for his life. Height's brain injuries affected parts of his brain that regulate basic life functions, and so it seemed unlikely he would be able to return to normal life, the site states. After much discussion, reflection, and prayer, the family made the very difficult decision to remove all life-saving interventions that are keeping Corey alive, the site states. Height was moved to a hospice care unit closer to his family until he died Sunday morning. The family announced his death on the Caring Bridge site, stating, quote, "It is with great sadness that our beloved Corey has passed away and gained his wings today," end quote. And also on Iowa Today, Coraville motorcyclist dies in a Cedar Rapids crash. Police are investigating a Sunday morning crash that killed a motorcyclist, 28-year-old Felicia Tharp of Coraville, authorities said. Cedar Rapids police were called at 2:30 a.m. to the Wright Brothers Boulevard exit, southbound Interstate 380, for a report of a fatal motorcycle crash. Officers found evidence that Tharp's motorcycle had collided with a deer and then been hit by another vehicle, which police have not yet identified, according to a news release. The crash remains under investigation as police seek to locate and identify the driver of the other vehicle. Anyone with information is asked to call the Cedar Rapids Police Department at 319-286-5491. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial is a reprint from Sunday's Washington Post, and the title, A Barrier-Breaking Triumph. The four high school girls looked skittish as they stood before the school board in conservative Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in mid-April. Then they started speaking about why they wanted the board to vote to allow girls wrestling to become an official varsity sport at Carlisle High. One shared how she was bullied to the point where she would hide in the bathroom after school. Joining the girls' wrestling club this year gave her the confidence to take charge on and off the mat. Another girl watched her brother wrestle for years and wanted the chance to be part of the sport too. Another joined the club at Carlisle after transferring from a school where she had to wrestle mostly boys since there was no girls' team. A week after the girls spoke, the school board approved the high school girls' wrestling team, joining more than 100 others across the state. A month later, Pennsylvania became the 39th state to make girls wrestling an official high school sport. The rise of high school girls wrestling is one of the greatest stories in U.S. sports in recent years. In the 1990s, a girl who wanted to wrestle had only one choice, join the boys. Many early female wrestling pioneers were taunted and booed in high school gyms if they got the chance to wrestle at all. But slowly, scenes such as the one in Carlisle played out. Girls would form a club team, word would spread, and other schools nearby would do the same. Coaches, often former male wrestlers with daughters, would agree to coach. Programs would grow and state athletic governing bodies would take notice. In 1998, Hawaii was the first to approve girls wrestling. Texas followed in 1999, but the vast majority of the 39 states that have embraced girls wrestling have approved the sport in the past few years, according to the site Wrestle Like a Girl. Next season, Carlisle girls will get the opportunity to compete for the first official Pennsylvania state championship in high school girls wrestling, something that would have been unthinkable only 5 years ago. The expansion of high school wrestling shows how to grow a sport and change perspectives. It's also a reminder that athletics, while far from perfect, often have played a key role in breaking down racial, gender, socioeconomic, and disability barriers in U.S. society. The expansion of high school wrestling shows how to grow a sport and change perspectives. The guest column today by Bruce Lear is titled, Educators, It's Time to Save Books. Book banning is nothing new for public schools. In the 1980s, I was teaching Lord of the Flies. I took a call from a grandpa convinced I was ruining his granddaughter's life by introducing her to characters like Piggy, Jack, and the gang. According to the grandpa, the book was porno about a bunch of boys stranded on an island who became savages. I was happy, at least, he understood the basic plot. But my happiness was short-lived when he called me a dirty commie liberal who shouldn't be teaching. I was 23, didn't know any communists, but knew I'd soon be fired. Just as I started to respond about the free exchange of ideas in class, and as the imaginary fife and drum music revved up his background, the phone went dead. I was furious. Grandpa hung up. But I discovered in my frantic pacing the cord had disconnected from the phone. I quickly plugged it back in to apologize and hoping I could finish my stirring speech. He was gone. Now I knew I was fired, but my principal visited that class a couple of times, got bored, and even dozed off once. I let him sleep. He didn't come back. The difference is that in the 1980s, Grandpa didn't have the majority party in both chambers of the legislature and the Iowa governor on his side, passing laws that gave him power to silence discussion about those stranded boys. Governor Kim Reynolds recently signed Senate File 496, a bill that contains a tax on public schools, and it means the educational family must work together. Part of the new law bans books with written or visual descriptions of sex acts from school libraries and classrooms, except for religious texts like the Bible, Torah, and Koran. There's absolutely nothing wrong with parents deciding what their children should read, but there's something terribly wrong with parents deciding for every child in the public school what should be read, especially if that decision is based on hearing just selected passages. Educators can't wait for the scream machine to kick in. The time to plan is now. School boards, find some of the many parents who want books in the classroom that educate and challenge kids. Unlock those voices. You already have board policies detailing procedures on removing books. This summer is the time to review and strengthen those procedures. For example, parents who want to remove a book need to have read the entire book, not just the passage they are objecting to. Find teachers and parents who will confront the complainers with questions. Don't overreact. Administrators, agree as an administrative team on the steps you'll take when book banning parents are at your doorstep. If one parent is screaming about a book, don't immediately fold like an old lawn chair. Use the process established by the school board. Teachers, don't start tossing books just because you believe they may be a problem. Get support from your principal before there's a book banning storm. President Dwight Eisenhower, no liberal, said it best, quote, "Don't join the book burners. Don't think you are going to conceal faults by concealing the evidence that they exist," end quote. Bruce Lear of Sioux City worked in public education for 38 years before retiring. And we have one community letter today, and the title, "We've Lost the Vision of Common Good." I found three stories in the May 30 edition of the Gazette. For me, it was one of the more interesting editions yet. First, there was excellent coverage of the Memorial Day ceremonies with a great picture of the American Legion Post 436 at the Fairview Cemetery. They were recognizing the supreme sacrifice made by many for our way of life. The second story was about the return of the remains of Army PFC Luther Herschel, Medal of Honor winner, to Georgia after 73 years. He stayed behind while the rest escaped to safety. This boy was 18 years old, yet he was concerned with others. Amazing at that age. The third story involved tenured faculty at universities in Iowa. In the article, Representative Steve Holt, Republican from Denison, expressed anger at liberals by using such words as free speech being attacked in Iowa universities. His comments were derogatory and the same type of borderline divisiveness intended to divide Iowans. I encourage you to read the legislature's website and read his comments about other humans after passage of the anti-transgender law he supported. His revision of history is unacceptable. In conclusion, the rhetoric used by Holt and others is an insult to those who have or are presently fighting for equality and country. My wife said it best when she said, quote, "We have lost the vision of common good," end quote. She hates politics, but dang, she is so right. PFC Herschel and the Legion Post 436 are shining examples of that good vision. And that is submitted today by Tim Trosky of Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, June 6th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page, and we start with the short notices. First, from Bellevue, Arlene D. Simmons, 94, died Thursday, June 1st. Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Bellevue is assisting the family. In Cedar Rapids, Alberta Paulette Stanick, 79, died Saturday, June 3. Tien Funeral Home. From Decorah, Roy Piper, 93, died Friday, March 3. Helms Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Maquoketa, Jean Buckner, 103, died Sunday, June 4. Carson Celebration of Life Center. In Postville, Marilyn Carol Christofferson, 90, died Saturday, June 3. Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service. And in Waukon, Jerry K. Weipert, 65, died Saturday, June 3. Again, Martin Grau Funeral Home is in charge of those arrangements. Turning now to the regular obituaries, first from Solon, Terry Lee Brosh, age 76, passed away Friday, June 2nd in his home following a lengthy battle with pulmonary fibrosis. Visitation for Terry will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 8 at Brosh Chapel in the Abba Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Celebration of Life Service will be at 11 a.m. Friday, June 9th at the Brosh Chapel. Private family interment will be at a later date. From North Liberty, Rose, known as Rosie Marie Ryan of Iowa City, formerly of North Liberty, passed away May 27th. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 17th at St. Thomas More Catholic Church in Coralville, where a rosary will be said beginning at 9 a.m., followed by a brief time of visitation before the Mass. Following Mass, a reception will be held at the church prior to the graveside services, scheduled for 2 p.m. at the Calvary Cemetery in Ryan, Iowa. To share a thought, memory, or condolence, you may visit Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service, gayandchia.com. From Coralville, Dolores, known as D. May Hill, 91, passed away June 1st at Lantern Park Specialty Care. Honoring her wishes, cremation has taken place and accorded with. Burial will be held in Arvada, Colorado at a later date. Lansing Funeral is in charge of arrangements, and you can read a full obituary at lansingfuneral.com. From Central City, Douglas, known as Doug James Ryan, 71, passed away Saturday, June 3 at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital. Visitation for Doug will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, June 6th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Central City. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 7th at St. Stephen's Catholic Church in Central City. Burial will follow at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Prairieburg with military honors provided by the Iowa Army National Guard Honors Detail. From Tipton, Bernard, known as Bernie Detman, on May 25 in a quiet little room in the Iowa City Rehab Center, Bernie stepped into eternity. Bernie, as he was known by his family and friends, was born on August 24, 1961 in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the son of Robert Edward Detman and Irene Doris Stout Detman. Bernie requested that his body be cremated and no fanfare be public, so remember him in the good times. You may contribute to the charity of your choice in Bernie's memory and share your online condolence at fryfuneralhome.com. From Cedar Rapids, Jerry Williams, age 81, passed away Saturday, June 3 at Promise House, Hiawatha. No services are planned. Please share your support and memories with Jerry's family on his tribute wall, stuartbaxter.com. And from Urbana, Roger G. Newton, age 79, passed away Friday, June 2nd at the ProMedica Senior Care in Cedar Rapids. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 16th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. Funeral services are at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 17th at First Christian Church in Center Point, and burial at Urbana Memorial Cemetery in Center Point. Please share a memory of Roger at murdochfuneralhome.com. Turning now to the sports page, high school baseball, unbeaten Prairie has a big week. Cedar Rapids Prairie is off to one of its best starts and will face its toughest challenge yet. This story by K.J. Pilcher. Cascade and North Lynn face off in a neutral field, while South Winneshiek takes on the new number one in Class 1A. Here are five notable games this week. Cedar Rapids Prairie is at Pleasant Valley. North Lynn is at Cascade. Mason City Newman is at South Winneshiek. And Liberty is at Cedar Rapids Jefferson on Friday. Saturday, Fight with Flash Crosstown Classic at Solon. The annual fundraiser event is centered on high school baseball games with all four Iowa City programs, Clear Creek Amana and Solon, and that will be held Saturday at the Solon Recreation and Nature Area. Competition begins at 11 a.m. The Fight with Flash Foundation was created in honor of Austin, known as Flash Schroeder, a 15-year-old who was involved in West's youth baseball program before he died in 2015 after a year-long battle with T-cell lymphoma. Also in sports news, this story by K.J. Pilcher, Iowa City High battles back into IHSBCA rankings. City High has endured a tough schedule and injuries. The Little Hawks are starting to gel, resulting in some notable wins last week. City High earned its 10th victory Saturday and climbed back into the Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association rankings that were released on Monday. The Little Hawks are 9th in Class 4A after a week hiatus from the poll. As a whole, we started to come together much better this past week, City High coach Brian Mitchell said. We've had a challenging schedule with road games, late nights and early mornings for school, and again, unusual injuries, which has taken a toll, but feels like we're starting to mesh. The Little Hawks went 3-2 last week, including three games against ranked teams. City High posted a win over Linmar and previously 4A number 8 Waukee Northwest that bracketed a 4-1 victory over 3A number 1 Western Dubuque on Friday at Mercer Park. DJ Hodges led the Little Hawks with two hits and two runs. Drew Carlson and Dominic Salibi added two hits apiece. It was a complete team effort win, Brian Mitchell said. Jake Mitchell and Talon Young kept their hitters off balance. Our defense was solid, and we did enough offensively to keep a comfortable lead throughout. Ankeny Centennial, at 10-0, is top-ranked in 4A, Western Dubuque in 3A, and Mid Prairie in 2A remain number one. Mason City Newman, at 13-1, took over the top spot in 1A. In sports of area interest today, in high school softball, Linmar is at Washington, Cedar Falls at Jefferson, Waterloo West is at Kennedy, Iowa City West at Western Dubuque, City High is at Dubuque Hempstead, and Liberty is at Dubuque Wallert. In high school baseball, Ankeny is at Xavier, Linmar is at North Scott. It's the state co-ed tournament time in high school tennis, and also state co-ed tournament time in high school golf. Turning now to the Business 380 page, David's Bridal in Marion is to close June 27. The David's Bridal store in Marion is scheduled to close, according to a store employee, and the national chain is seeking to lease its store in Collins Road Plaza. David's Bridal, in business since 1950, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in April. It also had filed for bankruptcy in 2018. The Pennsylvania-based company is one of the largest retailers of wedding gowns and formal wear, with about 300 stores and more than 11,000 employees nationwide. More than 9,200 of those employees across the country are expected to lose their jobs, according to the Associated Press. In Iowa, the company will lay off about 100 people in its four stores this month, according to a Workforce Adjustment and Retraining Notification, or WARN, notice that was filed April 14. The notice listed 26 layoffs at the Marion store, which opened in April of 2005, 29 in Clive, 22 people in Davenport, and 17 in Sioux City. The 9,000-square-foot store at 1402 Twixt Town Road in Marion is being offered for lease at $8.50 per square foot, one of the lower rents among the chain's 300 stores. The Marion lease ends April 30, 2025, according to an online bankruptcy auction list. James Markham, CEO of David's Bridal, said in a recent news release that the company had modernized its marketing and customer interaction processes, but that it continues to be challenged by the post-COVID environment and uncertain economic conditions, leading us to take this step to identify a buyer who can continue to operate our business going forward. And Donutland is to open an Urbandale location. Cedar Rapids-based donut chain Donutland is making its way back to the Des Moines metro area. Donutland, which came under new ownership in September of 2018, will be opening in a newly built location at 4820 100th Street in Urbandale, near the Quickstar, right off Interstate 80. Donutland management said it hopes to open around the end of June. The brand, which opened in 1971, once boasted locations across the Midwest. It now has two locations in Iowa, in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. Donutland has 40 types of donuts, including Long Johns, filled Long Johns, and jelly-filled Bismarcks, as well as coffee options. The Urbandale location will have a drive-through lane. And also on the Business 380 page, I'll abbreviate this story, Snapology, combining kids with Legos, learning and fun. From Marion, the motto at Snapology is that play is the brain's favorite way of learning. And at any given Snapology class or birthday party, that means a lot of playing with Legos. Everyone's crazy for Legos, said Deepthi Saja, who opened the franchise in the corridor in 2020. The business relies on the ever-popular Lego bricks to get kids engaged in learning about STEM topics, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. They are having so much fun, and they don't even realize they're learning. Saja, 37, decided to open the business after spending time at home during the pandemic when her husband, an engineer, began playing Legos with their son. In brief, the business is Snapology. The owner is Deepthi Saja. You can reach her at 319-382-2454. Snapology has hosted programs at the Hiawatha Public Library and Low Park Arts and Environment Center in Marion, for example. The Snapology team also hosts in-home or off-site birthday parties for kids. Turning now to the community page, Clear Creek Amana to break ground on a new school. This story by Grace King. The Clear Creek Amana Community School District is breaking ground Thursday on a new elementary to be built in Coralville. The public is invited to the groundbreaking at 4 p.m. Thursday. The school will sit on 30 acres of land west of Coral Ridge Avenue and east of the intersection of 380 and Highway 6 in Coralville. A name has not yet been chosen for the new elementary school, and the naming process has not yet been laid out by the school board. This will be the fourth elementary school to be constructed in the Clear Creek Amana district and will alleviate overcrowding in its other schools. It also will be the district's largest elementary with a capacity of 600 students. Construction and furnishing of the school is being funded by a $65 million bond referendum approved by voters in March of 2022. The bond supports the district's long-term goals to support neighborhood schools, reduce transportation costs, retain small class sizes, and provide comprehensive vocational and career technology education opportunity for all. Other projects included in the bond referendum are remodeling, repairing, and improving existing playground spaces at the other elementary facilities, improvements to the district's middle and high school facilities, including a fine arts space in the middle school and high school, adding a career and technical vocational space at the high school, and replacing the middle school's roof. The land for the new elementary was purchased by the school district from the city of Coralville for $1. The land is worth $12,000, according to the Johnson County Assessor's Office. As part of the sale, the city will have access to the school when not in use by the district, including the school's gym, commons area and cafeteria, playground, sports field, and outdoor recreational facilities. Additional spaces to meet the city's needs for before and after school programming included a dedicated classroom, storage space, office space, and kitchenette. Coralville will complete off-site public improvements necessary to provide access and utility connections to the new school. Projects include extending Oakdale Boulevard by June 30th of 2024 and constructing what will be known as School Street by no later than November 30, 2023, according to the agreement. The city will also be responsible for building a regional stormwater detention basin, storm and sanitary sewer lines, and other utility connections. With Tiffin, North Liberty, and Coralville recognized as three of the fastest-growing cities in Iowa, the Clear Creek-Amana District estimates growing enrollment of 150 to 200 students per year, and the 10-year enrollment outlook estimates 300 to 350 students per grade level. Tiffin Elementary and North Bend Elementary will be over capacity by the 2023-24 school year. Projected elementary student enrollment also will be over capacity for all elementary buildings by the 2026-27 school year. Here are some Eastern Iowa briefs. The First Lutheran Church of Cedar Rapids will be holding a Pipes, Pedals, and Pie organ concert series this summer. The concerts will feature area organists performing on the second Tuesday of the month. Concerts begin at 7 p.m., followed by an old-fashioned pie and ice cream social. The events are free. Performing at 7 p.m. June 13 will be Barbara Ritchie, organist at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Robbins. The other concerts will be held July 11 and August 8. First Lutheran Church is located at 1000 3rd Avenue Southeast. In Cedar Rapids, the Freedom Festival is seeking help filling a Hy-Vee delivery van full of non-perishables at the Balloon Glow Field, held from 4 to 10 p.m. June 17 at Jones Park, 300 block Wilson Avenue Drive Southwest. Donations will go to Freedom Foundation Pantry. The pantry is available to area veterans and their families. The pantry is open 4 days each week, and veterans can access it twice a month and receive personal care items once a month. Needed items include cereal, pasta, canned vegetables, canned meats and fruits, personal care items for men and women like toothbrushes, toothpaste, razors, deodorant, shampoo, and conditioner also are needed. Household items like laundry soap, dish detergent, Kleenex, paper towels, and toilet paper are also accepted. Performing at the Balloon Glow will be Days Live Music, the 34th Army Band's rock group, 42 Romeo, and the Bamboozlers. For more information about the Freedom Festival and its calendar, go to freedomfestival.com. From Amana, a free showing of the award-winning play Squatters on Red Earth. Swander Wilman Productions will present Mary Swander's new play Squatters on Red Earth, 8 p.m. Friday at Amana Performing Arts Center, 3938th Avenue, for free. Squatters on Red Earth was written by Mary Swander under the guidance of members of the Meskwaki settlement and supported by grants from Anon Was a Woman Environmental Art Grant from the New York Foundation for the Arts and the Iowa Historical Society. The core story revolves around the Meskwakis and the Inspirationalists, a German utopian group that by 1855 had settled the Amana colonies on what had been Meskwaki land. The Meskwakis, forced to move to a reservation in Kansas, longed to return to Iowa. The state agreed to purchase, and the Inspirationists helped the Meskwakis buy back some of their own land, the two groups both grounded in their own spiritual traditions and a desire to be removed from the outside world, coexisted peacefully together. This drama is enacted through the use of a cranky, a medieval puppetry device designed and built by Shelley Buffalo of the Meskwaki settlement. Shadow puppets were made by Monica Leo. This performance is free and open to the public. Tickets are first come, first serve at the door. The play runs 1 hour, and a talkback discussion follows afterward. And in things to do today, discover the oldest section of the downtown Cedar Rapids area with Kyle Patrick. This walking tour includes information on the development history of the evolving city center, its famous retail past as Eastern Iowa Shopping Center, railroads and streetcars in the area known as Green Square. That takes place at 6 p.m. today. Meet at the 3rd Avenue side of the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. Cost is $7 or $5 for members. And learn to talk about and document your healthcare preferences to ensure that your family, friends, and healthcare team know what's important to you and your wishes are honored. That takes place at the Ranshaw House at 515 Community Drive in North Liberty. That is at 2 to 4 p.m. today, and that is free. Finishing up with the top weather story by Hannah Messier, smoke and wildfires. The sky was hazy again on Monday due to wildfire smoke. Smoke from wildfires can travel hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles, especially when it climbs high in the atmosphere where upper-level winds can carry the smoke. We're looking for a chance of storms today. Cedar Rapids, projected high of 86, a low of 61. Iowa City looking for a high of 87 and a low of 62. The normal high for today in our area is 78. The normal low is 57. We set a record high of 96 degrees in 1933, a record low of 42 degrees in 1924. Looks like partly cloudy for the rest of the week. Sunset tonight is at 8:39 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow at 5:32 a.m. That gives us 15 hours and 7 minutes of daylight. And we are in the full moon phase with moonrise at 11:51 p.m. and set at 8:54 a.m. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Tuesday, June 6th. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.